Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting The Kingdom Choir, Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Mr. Dennis Hart and our engineer, Cynthia McClure. Thank you for joining our show for the next hour. We are the living room of the radio station, where community comes to sit on our couch and talk about what it means to live in central Iowa. And it is the last day of September. Tonight, there are showers predicted and thunderstorms. Actually, could produce heavy rains. But temperatures should stay pretty warm, as they are today, in the 60s and the 70s. The rain and stormy weather is expected to stay with us pretty much until Wednesday night, when it should taper off. And for the rest of the week and the weekend, sunny skies are predicted in the low 60s, with the exception of Saturday, when there should be another chance of rain.
So this is really probably the last warm and humid day we're going to have for a while. Temperatures expected to go down 20 degrees. The last day of what we could call Indian summer, right?
Probably so, yeah. Although, I don't know, October could always surprise. October has been known to suddenly turn warm again, so we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard it put that we're the living room of the community, but if folks would like to sit back on their couches,
there's
I'll give them a rundown. Can I do my news from there?
With very fancy pillows.
There you go. Let's do a rundown of what happened around the state this past week, as we always do on Mondays near the top of this broadcast, and we are pleased to be able to do it. None of what happened last week captured as much attention as the ongoing and seemingly never-ending saga of that Altoona man who had made a sign. You know about the sign. It asked for money to buy beer during the ESPN game day broadcast before the Iowa State Iowa football game weeks ago. Carson King was his name. His sign has raised more than $2 million in donations, and he promises to turn all of it over to Children's Hospital in Iowa City. But last week, the beer company that had matched the donations severed its relationship with King because of racist tweets he had posted on Twitter 8 years ago when he was 16 years old. The company said it would continue to match the donations that had come in. Then, the Des Moines Register announced that the reporter who had written the story about King's tweets was no longer with the paper because of the reporter's own past inappropriate social media postings. Then, Register Executive Director Carol Hunter wrote a long piece in Friday's paper acknowledging that reporting on King's tweets had created a firestorm and saying the paper was reviewing its policies. Meanwhile, donations kept coming in for Carson King's fundraiser, including one from RagBri. Ironically, the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa, which donated $50,000. And yes, there was more. Governor Reynolds declared this past Saturday to be Carson King Day in Iowa. And there was more. King appeared in the crowd at Saturday's University of Iowa football game at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City. And like the other 63,000 fans in the stadium, he stood up at the end of the first quarter and waved to the children at the Children's Hospital. And that was the amazing week that was with Carson King. But there was more news last week, much more. University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld questioned whether the annual football game between his university and Iowa State should continue. This after band members at the U of I claimed that one of the members suffered broken ribs and another was assaulted as they left Jack Trice Stadium after the game. Harreld said he was not convinced the game should continue in either Iowa City or Ames unless, he said, we can protect our fans, our band, and of course our athletes. He said university presidents, athletic directors, campus security officials, and band directors need to figure out how best to protect students. Then, later last week, Iowa State athletic director Jamie Pollard fired back, accusing Iowa's band members of leaving through the wrong gate outside the stadium. He said that led to a logjam with existing fans and might have resulted in physical contact. Still later in the week, the Hawkeye band directors disputed all that, disputed what Pollard had said, and noted that Iowa State never indicated what exit gate the band should use. And while all this back and forth was taking place last week, three Iowa students filed police reports about what they said had happened. Stay tuned. There's more to come. And Ames made more statewide news last week with word that a jogger who was out for a run last Sunday night in a neighborhood near Banshell Park was hit on the head and stabbed at least three times. The victim suffered non-life-threatening injuries. It took place on Carroll Avenue between 5th and 7th Streets. Police said the attack was random. No apparent motive. The hunt still on for the male suspect. Also word that anyone who had recently used the City of Ames website to pay parking tickets was at risk because of a data breach. City said about 1,500 people used the website from July 30th to September 12th. That's when the breach took place. The information that was stolen includes encrypted credit or debit card numbers, first and last names, home addresses, and email addresses. Yep, just about everything. Everyone who used the website's being urged to monitor their bank accounts, and often. Still in Ames, still making news across Iowa, Federal Highway Administration told the city that four colorful crosswalks at 5th Street and Douglas, crosswalks celebrating the city's diversity, did not comply with standards used by road managers to design traffic control devices across the nation. The feds said the display of color creates dangerous conditions for pedestrians. City Attorney Mark Lambert said he did not believe the Highway Administration had any jurisdiction over the matter because Douglas and 5th are not federal roads, highways, or interstates. But a federal spokeswoman said it does have jurisdiction. Meanwhile, the Ames City Council decided not to respond to the Highway Administration last week. In the world of presidential politics, the Des Moines Register reported that its latest Iowa poll showed that likely Democratic caucus-goers in the state were almost evenly split on whether Iowa should keep its status as the first in the nation caucus state or convert to a primary. Doing that would be more inclusive, but could mean that Iowa loses its outsized role in American presidential politics. The poll showed that 42% believe it's more important for Iowa to retain its spot as the first test of Democratic presidential candidates, but 44% say it's more important to hold a primary election. Still in the world of politics, another Republican announced he would run against 4th Congressional District Congressman Steve King in next year's primary. Steve Reeder of Arnold's Park became the fourth Republican joining the race to challenge King. Reeder has worked in commercial real estate for 35 years. Meanwhile, a Colorado man admitted last week that he threw a cup of water on Congressman King. 27-year-old Blake Gibbons pleaded guilty in Sioux City to one misdemeanor count of assaulting a member of Congress in connection with an incident at a Fort Dodge restaurant last March. Gibbons faces 1 year in prison, a $100,000 fine, and 5 years probation. Also last week, another biodiesel plant in Iowa announced it was shutting down, and Governor Kim Reynolds again warned that federal waivers that exempt oil companies from using renewable fuels are hurting the state's economy. The latest plant to shut down is W2 Fuel in Crawfordsville in southeast Iowa. 16 Iowa workers going to be laid off. Earlier, two other biofuel plants announced plans to shut down. In another story, a second lawsuit was filed against Governor Reynolds and other state officials in connection with a new law that gives the governor more power over the commission that selects state Supreme Court and appeals court justices. The latest lawsuit by a Des Moines lawyer who was interviewed to be a Court of Appeals justice but who did not make the finals list alleges that the new law is unconstitutional. In Dubuque last week, a jury convicted an eastern Iowa hog farmer of using a corn rake to kill his wife. 43-year-old Todd Mullis was found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of his wife, Amy, who died last November. Prosecutors said Mullis had wanted to kill her for years and was upset because she was having an affair. Mullis faces life in prison without parole. In Story County, one of the three suspects accused in a Kelly home invasion in which an 82-year-old woman was assaulted withdrew his guilty plea last week. 20-year-old Manuel E. Balderas will now go on trial in December. The other two men accused in connection with the crime have pleaded guilty. Meanwhile, the Madrid man accused of hoarding hundreds of living and dead cats at his home refused a plea deal last week. That deal would have reduced his sentence to 1 year in prison along with an $1,800 fine and a mental health evaluation. 65-year-old Dennis Carlson's trial will take place next month. 176 living cats and 194 dead ones were found at Carlson's home last May. He's been charged with animal neglect and with failure to dispose of dead animals. In Des Moines, a police officer was fired for lying about being struck by a driver who had fled a traffic stop. Officer Lourdes Haydenfeld was fired for gross misconduct in connection with what the driver later called a frightening encounter. Haydenfeld was directing traffic during snow removal last February when she stopped a driver who, she said, smelled of alcohol. She said the driver sped away, clipping her on her arm with the car's mirror. Video from Haydenfeld's body camera contradicted that account. Meanwhile, it was reported last week that parents in western Iowa had lost their final bid to regain their parental rights over their four children who had been taken from them because of alleged mistreatment. The state Supreme Court split 3-3 on whether to affirm a judge's ruling that terminated the parents' rights. That means the judge's termination ruling stands. The parents were not named. Back in Des Moines, the city council took the first steps to give itself a pay raise last week, an 11% pay hike to be exact. Now, if the council approves the final two readings of that ordinance, members will take home about $29,000 a year, up from their current $26,000. The mayor will earn about $58,000 compared with the current $52,000. The pay rates would go into effect next January 1st. There was also word that 2 years after the state legislature threatened to dismantle Des Moines Water Works, the Central Iowa facility was moving forward with plans to regionalize the metro's water services. The new Central Iowa Water Works would provide drinking water for residents of Des Moines and other Central Iowa communities. Details about that plan will be released later this week. Also last week, word that a Polk County supervisor had questioned why an architecture firm was awarded a more than $800,000 contract to design the new sheriff's headquarters without going through the usual bidding process. Supervisor Matt McCoy brought up the issue. Typically, city and county governments make requests for proposals to receive bids for projects costing more than $100,000, but the Iowa Code does provide flexibility in some areas. Meanwhile, the West Des Moines Community School District announced it had stopped the Valley football team's volunteer chaplain from praying with the players before and after games. This after the district had received written concerns from parents that the prayers violated the First Amendment. In the world of college football last week, Iowa State University lost to Baylor 23-21. The University of Iowa buried Middle Tennessee State 48-3, and the University of Northern Iowa lost to Weber State 29-17. From sports to weather, there were all kinds of weather alerts around Iowa this past weekend as storms made their way into, around, and through the state. But the alert that made the most news was false. That's right. A fake alert was issued this past Saturday afternoon in Pottawatomie County. It was sent out because of a system malfunction involving the company that distributes alerts around Iowa. Oh, well. And one more note. You might have seen the long story in yesterday's Des Moines Register about one of the most iconic events in Iowa history, the visit of Pope John Paul II to Iowa 40 years ago this week. Well, coming up this Wednesday on Local Talk, Paul Weirson and I are going to talk with two reporters who covered that visit, Kevin Cooney and Dave Busick, who were both at KCCI-TV on that October day when the Pope came to our state. You won't want to miss what they have to say this Wednesday, right here on Local Talk. And that is your summary of a busy week of news indeed from around Iowa. That's a nice song. Wish I knew who did that. Do we know who did that? No, we don't. Okay. Hey, if you've just joined us, welcome. This is Local Talk Monday on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Dennis Hart, along with Ursula Rudenberg. We are your hosts today, and Joe Van Erdwijk is running for Ames City Council, representation of the 4th Ward. We are happy to have him here today. Welcome to Local Talk, Joe.
Good morning.
Welcome, Joe.
You bet. First off, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background.
Yeah, so I'm an Iowan born and raised. I've lived in Ames for 8 years. Started out over in Carroll County for a little while. Then my parents moved us to Cedar Rapids. Came here in 2011, and I've lived in Ames 8 years or ever since. Graduated from Iowa State, and I've worked for CyRide for 4 years now. So, you know, I've always been in the community. I've actually been a year-round resident for 6 years now. And, you know, always tried to get involved. I've been volunteering with the library for about a year now.
Joe, you're representing the 4th Ward, which is West Ames, Iowa State, and the western part of town. I've heard you a few times referred to as that student who's running.
Oh. Well, I'm neither a student.
So tell us, are you a student?
I actually graduated in 2017 with a degree in history and a minor in political science, so I'm not that student who's running.
Okay.
Just wanted
to clear that up.
Why are you running? You're running against an incumbent, Chris Nelson, in the 4th Ward. Why are you running against Chris Nelson?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of times working folks and the students who are oftentimes working folks in our community don't get the representation they deserve. Back in 2014, I was interested in affordable housing because back then, even today, even worse than today, affordable housing was a big concern and a big issue. You know, you'd have to have a lease figured out by late March if you wanted to have a place to live in August. So I think that back then I was looking at reading the Housing and Building Code, which I did because I was thinking about building tiny homes, and it didn't really get much traction there. The housing or the code doesn't really allow for that. And so when I graduated, I just continued to see affordable housing be a really big issue, see the fact that the cost of living in Ames and the cost of housing in Ames are really big barriers for people to call Ames home. A lot of people choose to live in the community surrounding us and commute into Ames. And I think that if we are going to grow as a community, we need to actually take stock of that and work to build those affordable housing or those build affordable housing and take advantage of the existable housing stock that we have.
And how are you proposing to make that happen?
Yeah, so we're kind of in a beneficial position right now because there is such a large housing stock because we did have kind of an overbuilding of apartments. I think that if we can look to take advantage of the existing homes, single-family homes that are being used as rentals right now, getting those back on the market for young families and young professionals to purchase as starter homes. Right now it's too expensive to build a starter home. You're looking at least $250,000 to build a home that's, you know, even 1,500 square feet. So we need to take advantage of the smaller, more affordable homes in our community that already exist. So personally, I don't want to claim to have the answers. Some of the options that I've come up with are a deed restriction or housing covenant if those homes are sold by the landlord back onto the market so it doesn't become a rental again. But I think that my first step, if I were to become a council member, would be to encourage staff to kind of build a study of our housing stock and work towards finding a solution.
You also have talked, and this is in an interview you did with the Ames Trib earlier this summer, that one of your priorities is bridging tensions between ISU students and permanent residents. What tensions do you see there?
Well, I guess we all kind of experience it on game day most of the time when cars are both sides of a street are parked with cars, people going to games. Some neighborhoods see that during the week because of the students who live in their communities. I think that we need to encourage year-round residents to recognize that the new neighbor that shows up in August shouldn't suffer the sins of the previous neighbor. And equally, the new neighbors who are students usually need to be encouraged to recognize that they have responsibilities to their neighbors to be respectful. So things like just encouraging them to go and talk with their neighbors and give them their cell phone numbers so that instead of reaching for the 911 or reaching to call the police, if there's a noise issue, they actually, you know, do the neighborly thing and reach out to their neighbor to solve the issue.
As you know, we went through this bruising battle a couple of years ago over the rental codes, and it's still being talked about. What do you say to neighbors in the South Campus area neighborhood and around Iowa State who went to the council and said, look, we've seen our neighborhood transition over 30 years from being mostly residential to mostly students, and students generally don't take care of rental homes the way neighbors do. What do you say to those neighbors? How do you reach out to them?
Well, I think that we've seen a little bit of work going on. I think that, again, it is really about building those tensions or bridging those tensions, creating conversations. One idea is that the city has a block party trailer. So encouraging or creating a block party system where the students and neighbors are encouraged to have a relationship and have more of a connection. Equally, I think that the Iowa State actually began a program that they're doing with the first week of engagement with apartments or homes in these neighborhoods that you're talking about that they know to be tenants or know to be rentals. And I think that that's a great step to kind of build in a week of celebrating the fact that our community does have this annual renewal. And you know, allows us to address the issues that those people have.
We had your opponent here recently, Mr. Nelson. The general sense we got from him was that he was running again because he wanted to complete a lot of the projects that he had started working on as a city council member. What do you see yourself as bringing that's different? Why do you think there should be a change right now? What's the vision that you think you're introducing?
As a working person, as someone who, as a student, struggled to make ends meet, especially during the summer when businesses do shift their hours around and ultimately cut their hours, I think that I bring a perspective that a lot of people in Ames experience today that they haven't necessarily experienced, say, 10 years ago.
And what's that?
It's the fact that Ames is really expensive to live, and the cost of college has increased drastically. The fact that the cost of living has actually gotten a little bit more difficult, especially with the massive increase in student population that led to that really tight period of housing issues or housing availability.
So you're saying in some ways it's become hard to live in Ames for some people.
It's become incredibly hard. And, you know, I want to challenge people to recognize that the people who struggle to live in Ames aren't just Iowa State students. There are lots of people in our community who are working poor, who struggle to make ends meet. We have lots of students at our community schools who are on free and reduced lunch. There are families behind those students. We need to recognize that there are people who are working a lot of the jobs in our communities that just don't pay well enough.
Now, if I understand you correctly, you said a few minutes ago that you'd like the city to somehow intervene with private property owners when rentals come up again to perhaps convert them back into single-family ownership. How can the city legally do something like that? How do you see that playing out?
So I guess I don't really take it to mean – I don't really see it as an intervention. It really is about an encouraging of landlords to sell properties that are not necessarily profitable for them as a rental at the moment back onto the market so that it can become that owner-occupied home. And the way that we could accomplish that, I don't have all the answers. I really do want to find the solutions. I think that we could look at some sort of tax incentive, something that gives the landlord some sort of benefit for taking that hit to their pocketbook for the benefit of the community, because we need those homes.
So you're trying to make it more affordable for more people to buy homes in Ames.
Exactly. There are a lot of people who choose to live in Gilbert and Nevada and Boone and then commute to town to work because they can't afford to live in Ames or they don't find it to be a smart financial decision. We need to make Ames more affordable for those families, those young families, those young professionals, because we need them to be here. We need their kids to be in our schools so that we can grow as a community.
Part of your campaign is based upon what you call – well, what is known as the Ames 2040 plan. And for those who don't know, that's a plan the council's working on to try to figure out where growth should take place in Ames between now – in the year 2040, when they anticipate 15,000 more residents will live here. What's your feeling on where that plan ought to go?
Yeah, so the council has kind of taken a little direction that I think is most important. I think that's the infill part. I think that taking the time to find the places in our existing community that can accept more residents, where we can, you know, for lack of a better word, put a new coat of paint on our community because some of our neighborhoods could use some reinvestment, rather than first looking at paying for new infrastructure to an annex plot of land to build a new suburb, to build a new development like Somerset. I think that we need to first make sure that we're taking care of our existing community.
As you know, they're looking at several specific locations for future growth, north, south, east, west. Is there a spot, a direction you would like to see the city grow?
I really can't say for sure based on a lot of the specifics that have come out, or at least the pros and cons that the consultant firm has laid out. I guess I'm leaning against going north because a lot of the financial barriers that come with extending infrastructure that way. Ultimately, though, I don't really have at the moment a particular direction that I favor.
Okay. Yeah, the infrastructure issues is, as you know, one of the major blocks to north because there'd have to be a connection built to I-35, mm-hmm. and that would cost millions of dollars. The council's talked about that. What about west, though, like a campus town and the area west? A lot of folks want to build west. Developers like north, too. But west, you run into Boone County at some point. Is that a barrier?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's a barrier that can be overcome. A lot of people have the same concerns about north with the Gilbert School District,
right,
with going into Boone. But I think that You run into the similar issues to some extent in the West as you do in the North. You have issues with the Onion Creek area, building in that area, and equally, which is, I guess, northwest. It's over by Ontario, west of Ontario. And, you know, south of 30, you kind of run into some issues there as well. But I do think that when you're kind of doing the cost-benefit analysis, in west does look better than north, in my opinion.
It does. Okay.
I'm still thinking about the statement you made about Ames being a hard place to live for some people. Do you feel that as a candidate you're bringing in a fresh vision for that, a new way of looking at that that is not being currently addressed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have nothing against the current council members at all, but they have not lived in the Ames of today. They don't know what it's like to be financially restricted to such a serious extent that you are one accident away from being in financial ruin. And we, you know, there's a lot of people in our community. There's 13,000 residents that are below the poverty line. Some people would say, well, that's just all students. And again, I would argue that's just not true. There are lots of families in our community that struggle financially.
So you really feel you're bringing a particular insight that is somewhat new to the council?
Absolutely. I mean, I want to see Ames grow. I want to see, you know, growth economically, growth culturally and socially. But I want to make sure that before we grow, we make sure that our foundations are solid, because we've seen a lot of communities that have grown before us and they've had increases in homeless population. So you've seen people who have slipped out of that poverty position into homelessness. You've seen people who, you know, become or struggle with, you know, drug addiction, another thing that Ames does have a problem with that people don't often talk about. And so I think that making sure that we have those foundations, you know, they're solid is important.
And what skill do you as a person bring to all this or to the council?
Well, it's my personal life. It's the experiences I've lived. It's the fact that the entire time I've lived in Ames, I have been that person. I have the ability to understand the research as a person who, you know, has a degree in history. I've, you know, spent 4 years of my life learning how to do research, how to understand the nuances of studies as a political science minor, equally understanding the nuances of statistical analysis of the different, you know, roadmaps that our city develops to do different projects or to have foresight. And I think that not only do I bring the abilities to address those, but I also have the time. You know, I have a job, but otherwise I want to dedicate my time to the community.
If you've just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Dennis Hart here with Ursula Rudenberg, and we're speaking with Joe Van Erdwick, candidate for Ames City Council, 4th Ward District. Joe, one of your campaign issues on your website is growing opportunity. You've talked about that just a little bit. You say supporting business. What does that mean exactly, supporting business?
Yeah, so it actually is a very specific model called economic gardening. It was pioneered in Colorado and ultimately has been adopted by several states, including Florida. The idea is that while we do not want to stop looking for employers to attract to our community, and we don't want to stop trying to generate startups within, you know, entrepreneurial spirit that we have in our community, we do want to focus on the existing businesses in our community that have the capacity to grow. So giving them the resources like a social media expert or like a logistics expert that they can go to, ask them serious questions about how their business can grow. That way it's a really low-cost input that all of our businesses can use, and those businesses can then grow so then our employees can get better wages so we can have better-paying jobs available. So
okay. That's
the model I'm looking at.
So social media help, what else besides that would help businesses grow their business and enable them to raise wages? What else are you suggesting?
Well, like I said, logistics. So obviously transportation and material is a big issue in our 21st century economy because everything is supposed to be, you know, 2 days away. So I think that having someone who you can reach out to, whether that person is under the Chamber of Commerce or in a city department, knowing that someone has the expertise and the understanding of the regional logistics networks that exist and the people that a small business or a medium-sized business can go to in order to answer the logistics questions or provide them logistics service to ship their materials, I think is you know, another example. Equally, you know, just generally a business manager who can help build the strategic plan for a business, because oftentimes these businesses are pretty stable, but they don't necessarily know which direction to grow in, whether they should become a shipping expert or whether they should focus on expanding stores in the local area.
And where do you see this in relation to the Ames Chamber of Commerce? How do you see them being part of this?
So the Ames Chamber has done some really good work. I think that right now, after talking with John Hall, the economic development lead there, it feels like a lot of the components exist, but no one's taken the time to draw them together into a network that works together. So we do have – Iowa State has the SciBiz Lab down in Research Park. There is, you know, an entrepreneurial spirit that we try and cultivate with students at Iowa State, and I think that giving them the opportunities they need – a perfect example would be I was talking with the small business development folks down there, and they're saying that one thing that they lack is storefront or store space to, you know, grow their business and to share their ideas with other people in order to actually have the space they need to grow their ideas. And I think we need to, you know, build that network and maybe provide that space so that we can, you know, have that network of both startups into established businesses into growing businesses.
You also had spoken about energy. You want to speak about that for a few minutes, where you have a vision for more sustainable energy?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that Ames is positioned better than anyone because we have a Tier 1 research institute. We have Iowa State here. The fact is that, you know, a lot of the technology has been developed already. The SunSmart program we have, the 2-megawatt solar panels that we're going to be putting in, is really great. But I think that we need to make sure that the city is continuing to be a leader in renewable energy. So, engaging the students, giving them the opportunity through potentially semester-long projects to look at developing different kinds of renewable energies that Midwestern towns can utilize, so we can be a leader, and then we can share that information with our fellow Iowa cities. But more specifically, I think that right now the electric utility gets 20% of its annual energy from a purchase power agreement, which is purchased off the grid but comes from wind energy. So I think that signing another agreement where we get another, you know, doubling our energy consumption that comes from renewable energy at a lower cost compared to what we originally signed the first agreement for is a great way to illustrate that we're, you know, striving to be more energy efficient. We're striving to be aware of the impacts of climate change. But equally, we're just making good financial decisions for our community.
I'd like to ask you a question that may seem off the wall. Now, as the 4th District representative, you would represent Iowa State and the area around it, but you're also a city councilman for the entire city. How do you feel about the importance of downtown? Because we know that West Ames is growing. We know that Somerset is growing in the north part of the city. And yet when I walk Main Street, I see some vacancies, some storefront vacancies that trouble me. I'm wondering, what's your impression of the importance of downtown, and what would you do about the maintaining downtown?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the work that the council's been doing is really good. I think that we need to continue to encourage the opportunities for businesses. A great example is, you know, it's kind of difficult to pay for storefront revitalization, kind of one of the drawbacks to some of these vacancies you're talking about. There's a downtown facade grant that exists, so the city is willing to work with businesses to, you know, renovate their facades. So it's a great opportunity as a business. If a business moves in, if they're aware of that, they can use it to, you know, put that new coat of paint on their business. But ultimately, I think that just as important as we see growth in those other areas, I see 6 areas in our community that need to be invested in and continue to be invested in. So downtown is one of them, Campus Town. I think Somerset needs to be continued to be invested in. I think that Southwest Ames is one of those areas that we're really lacking, building out some commercial space there. So for me, it is about recognizing that downtown still needs some investment and some focus, but we need to make sure that other components in Ames are equally being invested in.
Council made a misstep, which they acknowledged a year or so ago, when they dramatically raised the rates for parking meters downtown, and they backtracked on it. They cut it back in half. Do you see the need for parking meters downtown?
I struggle to answer this question a lot, but I think that there are some really intriguing opportunities that exist at other cities. Some cities are going to smart meters that actually alter their rates depending on the time of day. So it would allow us to adjust essentially in real time the cost of parking based on the demand for it. Obviously, the benefit or the purpose of parking meters isn't to just penalize people for parking. It's supposed to encourage turnover so that people do – our businesses do have more economic activity at their storefronts. We're not trying to scare people away from downtown. We're not trying to scare people away from these commercial hubs, but it does serve a purpose. I think that one of the things that's really interesting to me, though, is looking at maybe transitioning to a rather than a minimum parking requirement, where as developments exist or as developments go up, they're expected to have a certain number of parking spaces. I think that maybe transitioning to a maximum parking requirement might be more beneficial because, as you're talking about, there is, you know, not necessarily that many – there's not that great of demand for parking sometimes. You're talking about those storefronts that are vacant that may not draw the traffic that they otherwise would. So maybe instead of having vacant parking spaces, you know, maybe we should be utilizing them better. I'm thinking of a recent development that's looking at going into the North Grand Mall. You know, that parking lot has – the mall has tons of parking spaces mm-hmm. that are notoriously empty, and I think that – you're seeing some interesting developments there where they're looking at actually putting buildings in the parking lot spaces to actually create some more economic opportunity for people.
Thank you. Excuse me. Joe, as we close up our conversation here, tell us anything else that you'd like to talk about. And I would like to ask you also to give us your founding story. Tell us about the moment when you decided to run for city council and why that happened.
Yeah, so, you know, I've been following city council for quite a while. Like I said, back in 2014, I was, you know, rummaging around in the housing and building code. But it wasn't until this 2040 plan came to be or began being publicized that I started to really think about, you know, running for council and making sure that, you know, working folks' voices were heard. Because oftentimes when you do have annexation and development, you see neighborhoods that become even more dilapidated than they are, because the investment actually, you know, migrates to those new spaces. So it was April 9th. I was at a city council meeting, and they were talking about the Ames 2040 plan. And after the meeting, I, you know, reached out to my family. I reached out to several close friends, and I talked to them and ultimately came to the decision in the middle of April to run for city council because I really do think that these working folks – need a voice on council. I think that we need to recognize that we need to make sure our foundation is really solid so that we're not losing out on the character of Ames that is so amazing and the reason why so many people live in Ames. I would encourage everyone to make sure that they're registered to vote at their current addresses. The election is November 5th, and please do check out joeforames.com. That's J-O-E, the number 4, A-M-E-S. And please consider contributing. I really appreciate that. And again, don't forget to vote.
We should also point out that you and the other candidates running for council are going to be at a forum tomorrow night put on by the Ames League of Women Voters, going to be from 6:30 to 8:30 in the city council chambers at City Hall on Clark. And that, again, is tomorrow night. So you're going to be there, your opponents will be there, and all the other candidates are going to be there. A good chance to learn about all of you in one fell swoop.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour, here with Mr. Dennis Hart for the very last time before the snow starts to fall. Dennis is going back to California. He will be here on Wednesday and Friday.
And next Wednesday and Friday.
All right, but I won't be here.
No, you're the one who's leaving.
So this is our last time together, so we one more time have to do a thing that I love to do. Which is talk about the wild ones,
the wild
Dennis.
Ones. And we are very good at talking about it. Why don't you start?
I got two things.
Okay.
Okay. First is, you know, I've been telling you about the cricket in the bathroom.
Yes,
been in there
all summer long.
Who's been there for months.
In our bathroom, the one at the station.
And I'm told that what he's doing in there is trying to attract a mate.
Yes.
And we've never seen him, but we certainly, he's become part of the soundtrack of the radio station.
Yes.
Well, about half a week ago, all of a sudden the sound stopped.
Uh-oh.
And I was like, well, where's the cricket? The cricket. He's being quiet. Okay, so I go into the bathroom where he lives, and I'm using the sink to wash my hands, and guess what I see floating in a cup of water that was in the sink waiting to be washed?
I hope it's a cricket doing the backstroke.
It was the cricket, it was his body.
Oh.
And so I had been hoping that when he stopped singing, that maybe his short little cricket life had come to a natural end. But it looks like what happened was that he got thirsty, and he went up to the sink to get some water, and he fell into the cup.
Oh, gosh. Oh, boy.
So props to the cricket. Thank you, Mr. Cricket, for all of the natural sounds you provided for months at KHOI, and we do miss you.
Jiminy Cricket, we're going to miss you.
We're going to miss you, Mr.
That.
Cricket.
Okay.
It's a little bit of an undignified end to die in a coffee cup, that's the life of a cricket, I guess.
Well, I have a quick story about a squirrel, and this happened last night. I had a couple of squirrel stories. I'll confine it to this one. I'm walking near Roosevelt Park, and, of course, I talk to squirrels.
You do, and they seem to talk to you,
and
too.
And rabbits, talk to them.
Yeah.
But this squirrel saw me, and of course, he goes up the side of the tree, always the side.
Squirrels have a lot of things that they think about.
They do. But he props himself on the lowest branch as I'm walking underneath him, and he's looking down at me.
Mm-hmm.
And he has an acorn in his mouth, and he's looking down at me. So I start talking to him. I literally do. I say, now look, buddy, I'm not going to harm you. I like you a lot. I hope your life is good. I hope you're storing stuff for the winter. He's looking at me and occasionally chews a little bit on the acorn, right, while he's looking at me. And then I do this for maybe 30 seconds.
Yeah, who the hell are you?
Well, yeah. And I'm looking around to make sure no neighbors see me so they don't call 911 on me. But anyway, finally, this little squirrel, he's just – his paws are right in front. He's looking down at me. His tail starts going up and down.
Aww.
His tail goes up and down, so I've got his interest, and then he makes a move as if he's going to jump on my face. And I immediately, I'm not kidding, he starts tensing like he's going to jump right on my face, and I immediately moved away. Now, I have no idea what his or her intentions were, but I didn't really want to find out at that moment, because if I'd come in with my face all scratched up today, you would have said, did a squirrel come after you? And that's my story.
We choose to believe that he wanted to jump on your face because he liked you so much.
Maybe he did. He maybe wanted to embrace my face. Yeah. But there was the tail went up and down that worried me a little bit.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a warning sign that you're getting a little too close.
So
speaking of danger and wild ones, I had an interesting experience over the weekend.
Oh, boy.
Okay. I went to the car wash.
Yes.
And I have a Corolla, so it's a little car.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm in the car wash and all the, you know, everything's coming down. And then I realize that I'm in the car with a wasp.
Oh gosh.
Holy
cow.
There's a big wasp.
Okay.
And he's flying around my car.
Uh-huh.
Now imagine the dilemma.
Well, it's a big one. If you roll your window down, in comes all the stuff. And if you don't roll it down, you're going to be stung to death, right? What did you do?
Well, I didn't have any choice. I had to hope that the wasp and I could coexist in the same little space until the car wash was over. Luckily, the wasp was more interested in the windows, really, than me. And so we went through the car wash together, and he didn't sting me, but he was a big wasp, and he was pretty frantic. He didn't like being close. Now, when we got out of the car wash, I opened up my hatch or the sun space and all the windows. And apparently he left. But the other thing I was thinking about was, I was just wondering how far away from home this guy had been carried by the car and how if he was going to find his way home again.
Yeah.
Because they do have homes. I mean, they have, you know, nests.
Maybe he knew you were going to the car wash and needed a shower and hoping you would open the window so he could take a quick shower and come out. Cynthia's nodding her head no on this.
Cynthia's not convinced.
One quick thing, driving down I-35 a week or so ago, a wasp was in our car too. And our windows were rolled up because the air conditioning was on. And I see the wasp. I'm on the freeway driving and it comes right up near the steering wheel on me and I start screaming, ah, wasp, wasp, wasp. And Sharon has the wiser head on this. I didn't know what to do except to scream. She rolls down the windows to try to give the wasp an exit, which he finally takes on 35. But I was just screaming. Okay. Wasp, 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 which is not helpful. When you're doing 65 or 70, it's not helpful.
All right. We just have enough time to put in an educated wild segment, which is Mr. Patch Larbaum. He's going to talk about feeding birds, which is something we're all getting ready to do. So, Patch Larbaum.
Starting a bird feeding program. Anyone who has enjoyed listening to songbirds and watching their colorful flight can appreciate seeing a favorite bird at their bird feeder. Feeding birds has become a multi-million-dollar industry supported by people of all professions and ages. Bird feeding benefits people who enjoy seeing birds at close range. It's thrilling to see a mother cardinal coax her young to the feeding station for the first time, or to hear the chickadees and house finches welcoming a refill. Songbirds are much more vocal in summertime and contribute to the aesthetics of anyone's backyard. Bird feeders should be located near a favorite window. Songbirds prefer protected areas out of prevailing winds. Shrubs provide quick escape cover from attacking predators. So locate feeders near shrubs or thickets with a sunny exposure where possible. But avoid placing feeders too close to shrubs if neighborhood cats threaten birds at your feeders. Bird feeders should be cleaned annually with a mild bleach solution to inhibit mold growth. Different species of birds have varying feeding habits, so it is good to incorporate as many feeding options as possible into a good backyard feeder design. The bird feeder has been designed to keep the seed as dry as possible, to minimize waste, and to appeal to a range of bird species to provide aeration and subsequent drying. A dry feeder is a better feeder and will last longer. Moldy seeds may cause aspergillosis, a deadly bird disease that grows on wet grain and bread. A roof with a 2-inch minimum overhang is required to ensure a dry feeding area. Cedar wood swells when wet, providing additional tightness. The trough feeding area is also designed to minimize seed waste. The length of the feeder allows more than one bird to eat at a time. Blue jays can be quite territorial, but a length greater than 10 inches provides additional space for less aggressive birds to feed. And at 10 inches, you can have one nuthatch come in on one side and another nuthatch come in from the other end, and they won't be so territorial. Occasionally, birds such as house sparrows will throw seeds from the feeding area onto the ground, but the narrow trough area is not conducive to this behavior. Sunflower seeds, especially black oil sunflower seeds, are favorites of cardinals, chickadees, nuthatches, titmice, and at least 40 other species. And when feeding seed mixtures, some birds will kick less preferred seeds out of the feeder onto the ground to rot, so it is best to offer only sunflower seeds in the feeder rather than mixing it with other grains. Ground-feeding birds, such as juncos and true sparrows, prefer white millet, but will eat dropped sunflower seeds. Perches offer chickadees and tufted titmice a place to hold the sunflower seed by their feet as they eat. Lacking perches, these birds will fly to the nearest branch, possibly out of view, to eat the seed. Birds such as nuthatches will use any crack to wedge the seed where they hammer it open. And ground-feeding birds, like juncos and cardinals, prefer flat surfaces to land upon. A platform board attached to the feeder entices these birds, including woodpeckers. And a wire mesh side container can offer suet or peanuts. Peanuts are a favorite food of tufted titmice and downy woodpeckers. Feeders spaced at various locations and heights allow less dominant species a means to fly away from more aggressive birds. And aggressive birds, that would kind of include the nuthatches and blue jays primarily. House sparrows can be deterred from monopolizing the feeder by hanging monofilament fishing line around the feeder or draped from a halo above the feeder, or by feeding cracked corn or grains, which are their favorite foods, away from the main bird feeding area. Some suggestions on some things you can do around your bird feeder. Occasionally, birds fly into windows. Stunned birds can be put into a paper bag, folded down at the top, and held closed by a clothespin, and placed in a cool, quiet place like a closet. After about 30 minutes, take the bag outside, take away the clothespin, and hopefully your revived bird will fly from the bag. Marauding cats that threaten feeding birds should have a bell attached to their collar to warn the birds of their presence. Landscaping should be kept at 12-14 feet so that marauding cats can't lay in wait right at the feeder when their birds arrive. And sometimes hawks, especially sharp-shinned and Cooper's hawks, will disrupt feeding birds. Shrubs planted near the feeding stations should provide protective cover, escape cover, for the birds. However, the best approach may be to simply stop feeding for a time. The birds will then disperse to natural feeding areas or other more protected feeders in your community. And maintaining a healthy bird feeding station could provide immeasurable entertainment possibilities for your family and friends. The opportunity to share the oneness with the natural world that songbirds can provide is well worth the effort of setting up a bird feeding station at your home. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOY Community Radio, Story City, Ames.
And thank you, Pat Schlarbaum. And this is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour, here with Mr. Dennis Hart.
You hear things on this broadcast, on this show, on this station, rather, that you cannot hear anywhere else, and I think it's important things. It's not just the local news, and this has become even more important with what's happening with other media around town. Now, I'm being very serious about this. It's the type of special interest programs that you can't hear anywhere else. We've got a lot of volunteers who come into this station, as you know, Ursula, but our audience may not. And they all have their own individual interests, their own individual likes and whatever it is. And they produce that, and they put it on the air. And it's for audiences that are not being served by the other stations in the market. Not to do anything, not to say anything bad about them, their commercial operations. This is a non-commercial operation which allows you to hear things that are specialized, are important, and need to have a voice in the community. This station actually does give voices to people who otherwise would have no voices. I am very high on this broadcast, on this station, as you know. And so I think it's important to keep this going. We can always use people who want to produce programs, but as importantly, as you know, you talk about a fund drive, we need money to keep it on the air, because as we're in the studio right now, there we have an engineer, we have lights, we have electricity, we have a building that we rent. It costs money to keep the radio station on the air. So if you're listening right now, if this is the first time you've listened, well, welcome to Local Talk. But if it's not, and you've listened to us and always appreciated us, but said, they'll get by without us, well, maybe you ought to help out. Make sure that we can get by and continue to do this type of broadcast. If you like what you're hearing, not just now, anytime on the air, any hour of any day, give us a call, come down to the station. We can use your input. We can use your energy. We certainly can use your contributions. How's that for a pitch?
Thank you, Dennis. And the way to donate is to go to khoifm.org, mm-hmm. khoifm.org, and you will see the donate button. You can't miss it. And we will be coming to you in November to ask for money. But mm-hmm. if you can make a donation now, it just makes things move a lot faster. And to be honest, we need the money right now.
No, and that's always – and you know, and we say that, and people say, well, yeah, sure, but you're going to get by without it. Maybe so. But the point is, if you like what you're hearing here, you can't hear this anywhere else. This is a one-hour local broadcast, and this past summer – if we – I have a list of the people we've had on Local Talk. It's a list of who's who and who wants to be who and all of this. You're not going to hear those voices anywhere else in the community.
That's
important.
Right.
This is an important radio station. You're to be complimented. You really pushed to get this on the air 7 years ago, Ursula. You're the heart and soul of this thing. And I say this sincerely. I'm looking at you as sincerely as I can look right now through my glasses and without my glasses.
I'll take my glasses off.
I'll take mine off too. Oh, this is going to get very serious now. Now we're both without glasses. This is important. And I urge people who love this radio station, whether you listen 1 hour a week to a particular show, That show cost money to put on because it cost money to keep this gigantic organization, in terms of equipment, going to put it up on a tower so that you can hear it and online. So consider contributing.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis.
You
and
bet.
Again, that's khoifm.org where you can donate. And this is Local Talk. We've been your hosts, Ursula Rudenberg and Mr. Dennis Hart. Thank you for listening. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also remember, you can hear recordings of this show later at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also remember that KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, Backtracking, by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk, radio production workshop, as well as a show. So if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come on and join the Local Talk team.
And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Share the oneness.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting Cirque May. Wednesday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.